Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I am a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as the social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is targeted towards Academy members as well as those interested in learning more about our organization. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Williams. Dr. Williams is the current president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and prior to that, he served as the chair of the COVID-19 task force throughout its entire duration. Dr. Williams is an emeritus physician at Northwest Asthma and Allergy Center in Seattle, Washington, where he retired from active practice in 2021. Throughout his career, Dr. Williams has made numerous contributions to the specialty of allergy and immunology, and in particular has been heavily involved in advocacy across many realms. For those of you who have listened to our podcast series, he's been on three prior times, and I believe this makes him our first four-time guest. And with that, Dr. Williams, thank you so much for taking time to join us, and welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's my pleasure to join you.
Yeah, this is going to be great. And this is under very different circumstances from your prior episodes, of course. And you officially began your one-year term as the president during our annual meeting held in Washington, D.C. in late February, which was less than 6 weeks from the time of this recording. So I think I'd like to start by just asking, what are your first impressions of your new role so far?
Well, I was kind of surprised early on because there wasn't much happening, but that certainly changed in the last few weeks. There's just a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And my visibility to the membership is primarily through the president's messages that come out on a monthly basis. But there is stuff going on all the time and new questions and new roles that I wasn't really aware of until I got into this position. So it's very interesting.
And are you able to share anything that you that was really unanticipated over the last 6 weeks?
A little bit, perhaps. a lot of it I can't. But, I didn't realize that... For example, today I found out that I have to name board members to nominating committees for future board positions. And so that's kind of the thing. The president has to pick people to do different things. And a lot of that was unanticipated because you only participate in the leadership calls for about 1 month prior to your presidency. So you don't really get a lot of stuff, except what happens during those 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay. Well, you've known that you were going to be president for quite some time, for several years, as a matter of fact. And so you've sort of had time to think through this. And we talked a little bit about this on prior episodes. So other than sort of settling into your role and learning all that you get to do and have to do, what are you most looking forward to during your time as president?
Well, it's odd, but I think the thing that I'm most looking forward to is my meeting, which will be next year in San Diego, because that's sort of the culmination of everything that I've planned or will try and organize. But I also very much am looking forward to some of the international meetings that I'll be able to go to, such as the European Academy or the World Allergy Congress. It's been very enjoyable to make those international connections, and I hope to continue that.
And are you able to share with us your next big trip along those lines? What do you have lined up in the near future?
Sure, I'm going to be going to Spain for the European Academy of Allergy and Clinical Immunology meeting.
Well, that sounds lovely.
That's going to be the end of May.
Okay, well, excellent. And you've been quite busy in contributing to the Academy at a high level for years, if not decades. So far, would you say that being president is the busiest in regards to just the meetings and demands on your time?
I don't know if it's necessarily the busiest, but it's certainly the most complicated. I mean, when I was chair of advocacy, we had daily emails from Heart Health telling us what was going on in Congress. Mm-hmm. we had weekly phone calls and all kinds of letters to write and things like that. And with the COVID-19 task force, of course, there was time spent every day looking over the literature to try and summarize. But the presidency is another level. I mean, there's stuff coming from all directions, both international requests, issues related to different assemblies and committees within the academy. So it's really just as busy, but much more complicated. And I think it's going to get busier.
I have no doubt. And, you know, we talked about this on, I think the last time you were on and as being chair of the COVID-19 task force, and I was a member of that. And I know how much work you put into that role of just going through all of the research and data information. You've been quite busy for quite some time. Since we started the podcast about 5 years ago, we've had the pleasure of having each of the current president at the time to join us and discuss their initiatives. And we really appreciate you taking the time to join us as well. Can you give us a little peek behind the scenes as to when you started thinking about these initiatives and how those original ideas sort of became more finely tuned into what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, so I started as, when you're a member of the board, every June and November, you get to see the upcoming presidential initiatives or reports on the current presidential initiatives. So you're aware that if you happen to get elected to that leadership team, that you're going to have to come up with some initiatives. So during my year as Secretary Treasurer, that's when I started thinking about it. And it gets refined by presenting at the at our board of directors meetings as president-elect in June and November, and again in February. Plus, I did meet at times with Becky Brandt and Tom Fleischer, who are executive director and executive vice president of the Academy, and kind of bounced my ideas off with them. And so in September, I got to present them to the staff at the Academy office, which was fun. So you get sort of constant feedback from staff and from members of the board on little refinements that you can make to the initiatives. The initiatives, the president's given a fair amount of leeway in forming those initiatives. I mean, there's obviously some restrictions based on staff resources and things like that, but I got a lot of help in bringing them together. As far as the topics, environmental health has been something I've been interested in since fellowship, when I did some research on criteria air pollutants and airway disease. And while I've never gotten particularly involved during my years as a practicing allergist, it is something that's impacting all of us. And we'll talk about that, I think, later. But it impacts our patients and then our practices as well. And, of course, then the academy.
Now, I think it's helpful, and I appreciate you sharing that, as we've learned from your predecessors, of you all have your own, obviously, your interests and things that you're passionate about, and then you're able to sort of use your role and the academy, frankly, and membership to bring it to fruition. So I think that's great. And then typically, the presidents will develop new task forces to help those initiatives come to fruition. But you've sort of taken a different approach, and you plan to utilize existing committees and structure to implement your vision. What made you decide to take that route?
Well, the keys are staff, resources, and sustainability. That's really the basis for that. I originally started with task forces because everybody else has been doing that. And then after meeting with Becky and talking about it, she pointed out a very vital point. And that is that when you have a task force, it sort of takes away from other activities that those people may otherwise be doing. And plus, when you have task forces, you have to find a place when they're wrapping up to park them in the academy. So by utilizing existing resources and committee structure, it solves a problem of staff to a certain extent and staff resources, but also sustainability. So that's why we sort of pivoted to do it this way.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I think as we discuss these specific initiatives, listeners will learn more about some of the committees that you'll be engaging. But before we get into some of those specifics, can you just offer a more a broad, short overview of the academy structure to help our listeners better understand the hierarchy of things like the intersections and the committees and any other relevant bodies?
Well, I can do that. I don't know if I can do it simply because it's a very complicated structure that are actually trying to analyze and revise and make more efficient. But basically, the intersections are membership groups. You're encouraged as a member to join an intersection, and you just pick one that seems to parallel your clinical or academic interests. And then there's assemblies, which are also membership groups. So the biggest assembly is a regional, state, and local allergy society. So that's where most of the private practicing allergists live. Then we have the new allergist and immunologist assembly. We have the military allergist assembly. So those are other membership groups. Now, as far as committees, each intersection will have a variable number of committees. In addition, there are divisions within the board of directors. So there's the education division, the practice and policy division, and the research and training division. And each of those divisions have committees assigned to them. And then finally, there are board-related committees. So, advocacy, for example, is a board committee. And in those committees, the members are appointed by the board. So they're invited to be a member of the committee. For all the other committees, people can volunteer or sign up for those.
And what is the best way for somebody to volunteer or sign up or just get involved in a committee? And what advice do you have as in regards to why that's a valuable experience for both the individual and for the organization?
Well, sure. So every August, all the members in the academy get an email that says, "How would you like to join a committee?" And you have an opportunity at that point to sign on to committees. And there's about a month during which people can do that. And then in September, the president-elect meets with the executive director, and we review the committee chairs and vice chair selections. And in November, the board approves the committees and the committee structure and membership. And then, of course, those people rotate onto those committees at the annual meeting. But in reality, you can join a committee anytime during the year. If you go to the meeting and decide you want to sit in on a committee, that's welcome to do so. If you want to join a committee, all you have to do is email committees@quadai.org and say, "This is me. This is my name. This is a committee I'd like to join." And all of the committee assignments are approved by the board of directors. And so throughout the year, as I mentioned, in November, you get the big committee book where you approve all of the committees and committee chairs. But at the executive committee meetings after that, there's still lists of people that are joining committees. So it kind of goes on throughout the year. Now, why would someone want to join a committee? Well, I mean, for their own personal growth, their ability to collaborate with others. And their ability to educate, participate in the education of fellow members of the academy. So those are the main reasons for the member to join a committee. And committees are the lifeblood of the academy. I mean, virtually everything that happens at the academy happens through a committee. And so if you want to get involved, if you want to have a say in what your specialty organization does, you do it by joining a committee.
I really love that you pointed out that people can sit in on committee meetings during the annual meeting without being a member. And I think that's a valuable experience. So you can sort of get a feel for what the committee addresses, the topics that are discussed, and things like that. And I agree with you 100%. It's a wonderful way to get involved and just learn more about not only the organization, but just from a networking standpoint, you get to meet such great people by joining these committees. So I will second your notion to encourage people to get involved. That's great. Well, let's get on to the initiatives, the presidential initiatives that you've chosen for your year. And there's three separate ones, so we'll talk about each of them separately just to make it easier. And the first one, as you mentioned, it revolves around one of your earliest passions, and it's focused on the environment, climate change, and the impact on allergic disease. Can you just give us a little bit more background as to why this is important, not only to you, the Academy, our members, but also our patients? You touched upon this earlier, but tell us why this is, one of your major presidential initiatives.
Well, the thing about allergists and the diseases and disorders we care for is, if you reflect on it, they pretty much involve the organs that come in direct contact with the environment. So we're talking about skin, upper airway, lungs, and even the gut. And so the environment obviously impacts our patients and their diseases, and secondarily, of course, then us as practitioners and providers, and then the Academy, who's, of course, interested in developing the science and education and advocacy to move that forward. And so because of that, my feeling is that the allergist immunologist would be the preferred specialist on environmental impacts on health and disease, because that's what we deal with. And so I want to, and these sort of blend in with some of my other initiatives, want to educate the public about that as well. And so that's really why I thought about this particular initiative. It also gives us a great opportunity to, because I'm using committee structure, a great opportunity to promote collaboration within the different committees, so they can work with other committees and develop some of the educational and patient resources that we're looking for.
Along those lines, can you discuss some of the specific committees that you'd like to include in this initiative in particular, and then also the tangible products that you're aiming to develop along the lines of patient education materials and the like?
Okay, well, the list of committees is actually quite long, and several of them can work on different portions of this initiative. But as far as the environment initiative, there's the Environmental Exposures and Respiratory Health Committee. They're a committee of the Environment and Respiratory Disease intersection. SAMPRO, which is the School Health and School Asthma and Anaphylaxis and Food Allergy Group Committee. There's the Asthma Cough Diagnosis and Treatment Committee, the Rhinosinusitis and Ocular Allergic Disease Committee, the Microbial Triggers of Allergic Disease Committee, Committee on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, the Women's Health and Allergy, Advocacy, Practice Management, Division, and Program Directors. So all of those can be involved in this.
That is a lot of overlap, as you mentioned. I should have asked you which committees are not going to be involved. It would have been an easier answer.
Well, actually, there are many more committees.
Yes. So are there tangible products you're hoping to develop that will come out of this?
Yeah. I've kind of focused on two separate issues related to the environment. One of those is school health. I'm a pediatric trained allergist immunologist, so I think about school and the fact that my pediatric patients spend a lot of time in school, and a lot of allergists don't think about the environment in the schools. And things in the environment affect kids at school in different ways. They have outdoor play, they have exercise, they have issues within the classroom. So we want to develop some educational tools for the allergist to learn how to deal with schools and what's important about school environments and what to think about. We want to develop some patient tools and handouts and instructional material for parents of children to think about things related to schools. When I was a member of the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program back in the early 90s, I was on the school health subcommittee, and we had these checklists that people could use, parents of asthmatic patients, And basically, is your school asthma friendly? So there are different things that parents could ask about to make sure that their kids would be safe at school and their asthma wouldn't be exacerbated by exposures at school. And the other thing that I'm focusing on is wildfires and wildfire smoke. And that obviously has been a West Coast issue for many years. But last year, it became an issue for the Midwest and the East Coast as well. And that obviously has major impacts on our patients. And we need to educate our allergists on what are the components of wildfire smoke and how do they impact lung disease and upper airway disease, and what can we teach our patients about taking care of themselves during periods of poor air quality. So again, education for members, tools for the patients, toolkits for members, that sort of thing is what we're aiming for.
I think that all sounds great. You've spent the majority of your career really focused on advocacy and helping along those realms through the academy and other avenues as well. And you've tied in advocacy as well as research into this initiative. So can you talk about how those relate to the environmental impact on allergic conditions and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Yeah, well, advocacy really plays a role in a lot of the things that the academy does, even for the regional, state, and local allergy societies and for the society in general. But we've for a long time been collaborating with a group called the Medical Society's Consortium on Climate and Health. And we sign on to a lot of their efforts on legislation, federal legislation, to improve the environment or protect what we have at this point, make changes to affect climate change in a positive way. So we want to continue that collaboration, but also promote legislation that protects vulnerable communities from the byproducts of power generation. For example, the emission standards that the EPA just recently released on PM2.5 or particulate matter 2.5 microgram or less. And then we want them to make the connections between environmental determinants of health and other issues such as environmental racism. We want to bring the focus to that as well. And then research, it's amazing, is the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology recently had a journal that was dedicated to the environment and climate change. And it's amazing how many aspects of the environment and climate change can have impacts on respiratory disease. I mean, even temperature extremes of heat or cold can affect asthma control. And then the mechanisms aren't exactly clear, but reading about volatile organic compounds and TRP receptors and all of those things need to be, I think, better delineated so that we have the tools and the ability to take the best care of our patients.
Well, I think the first initiative sounds fantastic. There's a lot of work to be done, but we're not done yet. It's not, you know, you have two more initiatives, and the title of your second initiative is one of my favorites, I'll be honest with you. It is Communication Re-Emphasis. And I love how simple this is because I know how complex it really is. But can you tell us a bit more about what led to you to include this as one of your initiatives?
Well, after practicing allergy in a community practice for over 30 years, I was getting kind of tired of how everybody else sort of got into the allergy space and in some ways sort of disrespected the allergist. And so allergists didn't have really much of a reputation when somebody said, oh, what kind of doctor are you? And you say, well, I'm an allergist. Well, sometimes you don't get a very positive response. So I would always say I'm a specialist in asthma and allergy, and that kind of worked a little bit better. But I think the important point, and the Academy has thought about this in the past, but never really brought it to fruition, is we need to communicate to the public particularly, but also the payers and state and local governments and primary care specialists what allergists do and what we can do. And we have to do it in a way that doesn't denigrate other people that are trying to do allergy, because that runs into restraint of trade issues. So, you know, we have to really say what we can do, why we can do it, and why we do it the best. And I think that teaching primary care primary care physicians is really important. If you reflect, there are a lot of training programs in the country that don't have an allergy presence. Mm-hmm. And so they never really learn what the allergist does. They send their asthma patients to pulmonary. They send their skin problems to dermatology and their rhinitis problems to ENT. And they just don't know what the allergist can do, and the fact that we can take care of all of those problems. And I'm proud to say probably do a better job than any of the other specialists. So that's really where that came from.
Okay. As you were discussing that, you made me recall when I told my friends from medical school who went into, you know, become surgeons and neurosurgeons and things like that, that I was going into allergy immunology, several of them sort of laughed at me as if I was kind of taking the easy way out. Is what they made it seem like. And now, who do they come to for all of their own concerns about their children as well as themselves when they have allergy issues? Well, of course, they're calling me. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, what types of messages are important for allergists to use when we promote our expertise and the benefits that we can offer to our patients?
Well, we're just going to try and develop that. So things that we talked about are talking points and instruction for community allergists to use with the public and payers and primary care. So that would be encouraging the involvement of allergists in the education of primary care residents. We have a resident rotation curriculum that the Academy, there's another committee in the Academy that has developed a wonderful tool that local allergists can use to develop curriculums for allergy in primary care programs, to use them in their office and offer rotations for primary care residents. And you know, some collaboration with lay organizations will help some of this education as well. We talk about short presentations for our YouTube channel, for podcasts like we're doing today. Social media, we want to identify social media influencers in the Academy and sort of leverage them to get the message out. So, you know, it's a multi-pronged kind of approach that we need to take to deliver our message.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Dr. Williams. I've been involved in our professional organizations since I completed my fellowship 16 years ago, and I still don't fully understand the vast network of regional, state, and local allergy immunology societies. So can you help me? Forget about our listeners for a second. I need to learn from you. So can you just offer some insight into what these groups offer and how they can help with communication?
Well, there's a lot of variability amongst regional, state, and local allergy societies, and a lot of them are focused on education. And so they'll host a program, you know, the Chicago Allergy Society, for example, will host their annual meeting, and it'll be primarily education. And then there are other societies that also very much get involved in policy and also in education of other specialties, primary care in particular. So, for example, the Texas Allergy Society invites residents from several different programs to an annual meeting where they talk about allergy and immunology. And Dr. Dave Kahn, when he was president, started the ROAR program, where we had local residential, regional resident educational sessions. So despite all of this variability in the different allergy societies, the Academy has developed the regional, state, and local Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Society Assembly. And so any president or vice president of a local, state, or regional allergy society can participate in that assembly. The assembly has seven governors who look over the, I think it's up to eight governors now for eight different regions. So what they did was divide the United States into regions that roughly have similar numbers of allergists within them. So, the Pacific Northwest has several states, whereas some other regions may only have one or two states. So again, the goal is to get similar numbers of allergists involved. And so that, so those governors then interact with the presidents of the different allergy societies and act as a communication conduit between the board of directors and the regional, state, and local allergy societies. So the goal is to try and bring the concerns of the local allergists, practicing allergists within the academy and the board to try and help our members. So that's kind of the way it's set up.
Okay. And off the top of your head, I'm putting you on the spot here, ballpark figure, how many states do you feel that you've visited throughout your career, specifically for one of these state or regional allergy society meetings?
I personally have probably only visited two.
Oh, okay.
And that's, as a participant, I've been in the Washington Allergy Society, the Oregon Allergy Society. They have a combined annual meeting, so we've met with both those groups. And then the Western Society meets in Hawaii every year, so that's always a fun meeting to go to. So that's what I've been involved in. And I think it's important to point out that not every state has an allergy society.
Right.
And so part of the effort of the RSLs, we call them, and the governors, is to try and help establish societies in those areas. And the Academy has actually offered a grant of up to $3,000 per region to help promote that activity.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm glad you pointed that out. And here in my state of Ohio, we have, you know, major academic programs in Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and allergists throughout the state. And we didn't have a state society for many years until it was revamped just recently in the last few years through the Academy Leadership Institute, actually. One of my colleagues, Dr. Redmond, you know, used that as her initiative. So, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of states out there that just don't have these societies or that access. Now, one thing you included in your recent newsletter was that you believe it's important to improve our internal communications within the organization. So what does that actually mean?
Well, when you think about the Academy, you know, we just talked about all the different committees and we talked about all the assemblies and interest sections, but not everyone knows what's going on in the Academy. You tend to get involved in your little silo. So you get involved in your committee and you do your committee work, and you may be involved in your interest section that sponsors that committee, but you don't know what everybody else is doing. You don't know what the new allergist immunologist assembly is up to, or the RSL, or what committees with food allergy are doing with committees with asthma and cough and diagnosis committee. So my idea is to find some way to bring those silos together. And that's what the internal communication is. So I can find out as a member of a committee what other committees are doing, or as just a member of the Academy, what other committees are doing. And you don't really understand it until you become a member of the board of directors. And part of our job is to review the reports of all the committees. And it's, to me, been wow. There's a lot of stuff going on that I didn't even know about. And I've been very involved with the Academy for years. So I just think that we can bring them together, bring the academics together with the practicing allergists by utilizing those rotations. You know, there's specific skills that a practicing allergist has that an academic allergist may not. And most of the fellows that they train go into practice. So it makes sense that you might want to get some practicing allergists involved in your training program. If I'm developing a work group report on a specific issue, I might want to know what other committees within the Academy are working on that same sort of issue and maybe collaborate with them on that. So that's our focus. And that might be a little bit easier to accomplish than some of the other things. It's just a matter of sort of posting things where people can access them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, your third initiative and your last initiative focuses on removing barriers to practice. What types of barriers exist that impact our ability to offer high quality care to our patients?
Well, I mean, clearly access is a major issue, but that's not necessarily what this initiative is all about. This initiative arose out of my time with the Office of Practice Management, where I served as sort of the director of payer relations. And what that involved was reviewing policies from different insurance companies and trying to educate the insurance company about what a reasonable approach to authorizing procedures would be. And we would send many letters throughout the year to these companies. And some of them worked and a lot of them didn't. So for example, the criteria for using a biologic for asthma, for example, they were really hung up for years on you had to have an FEV1 below 80% predicted. You had to show bronchodilator responsiveness in order to qualify for payment for a biologic for your patient. Well, you know, we spent a lot of time explaining that biologics really do their best thing by reducing exacerbations. And there are a lot of asthma patients who have normal lung function when they're not having an exacerbation. So you're denying the people that would benefit the most from this drug by those criteria. So we tried to educate them along those lines. And the frustrating thing was that you'd convince one insurance company to do that, but then another insurance company would pop up with a similar policy that you were trying to change. And it was, to use a cliche, like playing whack-a-mole. You know, you'd convince one person, but then you'd have three others that would do it again. Or some of these companies, it sort of comes back again. You know, they change their policy based on what you said, and 5 years later, it's back in place again. So I want to try and develop a more proactive approach. When we're developing a new treatment or a new treatment regimen for a disease state, before it even gets to widespread use, why don't we meet with some of these insurance companies and present the data and the evidence behind that? And then as the treatment regimens expand over time, educate them again about, you know, we used to limit our use to this, but now we found here's the evidence behind why it might work just as well in this group of patients. And just have that relationship with these big payers so that we can easily talk to them and get them to think about changing some of their policies.
Oh, that'd be so helpful. What committees do you think will be involved in this initiative?
Well, the Office of Practice Management, because they have their payer relation wing, basically, and advocacy. And probably the Prior Authorization Task Force, they are meeting with some of the big insurers. So they're sort of paving the way, perhaps, for us to continue that process.
Well, Dr. Williams, these are three impactful initiatives. I look forward to hearing more about them as they get developed more fully. But what does that process look like in the coming months?
Well, you know, the message, my presidential message are going to be reminding people to do some of the work that we talked about. Prior to the meeting, I actually sent emails to all of these committees that we talked about, to their leadership, saying, here are my initiatives. Here are some things that you might want to get involved in. So now my job is to go back to those same people and say, okay, tell me what you're doing and how can I help you get it done?
So getting the word out and then communicating. I love it. Okay. Well, when your predecessors and past presidents were on the podcast and they were talking about their initiatives, they all discussed the similar ideas, how 1 year is really an impossible timeline for developing and then fully implementing any initiative. And these are really meant to be more long-term projects. And in preparing for this conversation, I realized that we don't often receive communication about these past presidential initiatives and their progress or impact. We sort of learn about them during that year, and then I don't know, unless I'm missing something. So do you think that maybe that could be added to your list of tasks under communication?
I think that's a great idea, Dave. And I think we can easily do that. When thinking about it, I thought maybe in Impact, you know, the digital magazine that comes out quarterly for the Academy, we could have a status report on previous presidential initiatives so people can see where they're at and what's going on along those lines.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for the idea.
Yeah. You've been a guest, as I mentioned, for three previous podcasts, and you've always been so gracious in answering some personal questions. We've had some fun. You talked about travel and hobbies, but I've never really asked you about your wine interests, mostly because I didn't know about them until you just included this tidbit in your March newsletter. And, you know, you live in the Pacific Northwest, and I can only imagine that there's a great selection of local wines. Do you mind sharing what are some of your favorite varietals?
Well, sure. So Washington has kind of a unique geographic setup. You know, we have the Cascade Mountains that run down the middle of the state of Washington. It divides the state into the wet western and the dry eastern part of the state. And most of the grapes are grown in the eastern part, and they have very similar conditions to the wine growing regions in France as far as longitude and latitude. And so Washington, as it turns out, can grow a tremendous variety of grapes. And there are people experimenting with all the different varieties of grapes. But my favorite happens to be Syrah or Grenache Syrah blends are the ones that I prefer.
I just discovered this, so I'm going to pick your brain if I may. My wife signed us up for a wine club just in the last several months, and we're getting six bottles from around the world, and we're just trying different varietals. So any advice for us as we sort of taste our way around the world in regards to sort of finding what fits our palate or anything like that? What have you learned in your exploration of wine?
I've learned a lot. I belong to a few wine clubs. We have areas near where I live where I can go and sample wines from about 120 different wineries. So, you know, the opportunity is there. These winemakers are all coming up with great new blends and new uses of varieties. There's a big difference between U.S. wines and European wines. So in the U.S., besides obviously the winemaker's approach, but in the U.S., you have to label a wine based on the varietal or the grape that's in it or the majority of the grape that's in it. In Europe, it's a region. And so, for example, in France, you have the Bordeaux region and the Burgundy region. And so you have to kind of learn what grapes are grown in that region to know what you're buying when you buy a bottle of Bordeaux or a bottle of Burgundy. And whereas in the U.S., you know, it says it's a Pinot Noir or a Cabernet Sauvignon or a blend of some of those grapes. And so Burgundy is generally Pinot Noir. Bordeaux wines are the Cabernet Sauvignons, the Merlots, the Cab Francs, Syrahs, Grenache, those kind of wines. And there's different regions, of course, within the Bordeaux that specialize in those specific grapes.
Well, I look forward to learning more and picking your brain in the future. Perhaps for your fifth, if you come back again as a guest in the podcast, maybe we can do that in person. Maybe, you know, at your estate, and we could do a wine tasting ourselves while we record.
That would be fun.
Oh, okay. I'm going to ask the board to put that in the budget, perhaps.
Well, the board meeting in June is in Seattle.
Oh, okay. Now, have you thought about what type of wine you think you'll toast with at the end of your presidential year? I know that's quite a ways in the future, but.
Well, it'll probably be champagne, but it'll be a bittersweet sort of approach. But I'm looking forward to this whole year.
Sure. Well, you know, Dr. Williams, once again, congratulations on becoming president. We're all looking forward to your initiatives and a wonderful year ahead. I know how busy you are, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time out to be with us today. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we depart?
No, Dave, you know, I appreciate your work. I think your podcasts are fantastic, and I always like to be invited to participate. And I only hope that we can use you in the future to get some of my initiatives done as far as messaging and communication?
Well, number two really speaks to my heart, so you know where to find me.
I do.
Yeah. Well, thank you again.
All right. Thank you. Bye now.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.